Chief Justice, fellow justices, Christopher Coist on behalf of Gerard Subieski. Having a lot of opportunity to think about this case, I have to highlight what I think is our strongest argument, and that is that the combination of factors of errors that occurred at the trial is the proper basis for a remand in this case. This would be argument four within the brief that relies on the three-part test from Hughes versus the state of Delaware, as was cited in Hunter. And that is looking at one aspect, which I think is very important, is the closeness of the case. Here we have a case in which there was a jury that deliberated until 7 o'clock the night before. They came back the next day, and they deliberated until 1:45 when they passed a note to the judge. So this was a case that required an Allen charge, even though there were multiple errors, and I'm sure you'll ask questions about that, that had some impact on the jury panel. In light of all that, they deliberated that much and needed an Allen charge in order to be able to convict. Of course, closeness of the case is one factor, but I should note, in Hunter, the court found that the case was not even all that close, because the three factors, you don't necessarily even need to meet all three of those factors. In that case, a drug case in which the evidence was not as close, this court remanded.
And just one procedural point. I'm just trying to understand the record. Your client is serving a life sentence. Is that under 4214A or B? Because
it's the mandatory. It's because mandatory. He had a crime of violence, it was required for the trial judge to give him a mandatory life without parole sentence.
Okay, thank you.
Now, the centrality of the issues that affected the alleged error, all of the issues that we had here went to the crux of the evidence in controversy. The driving of a vehicle where Mr. Subieski was alleged to have turned off the lights, whereas he testified, the lights flickered, the lights went off, his girlfriend, Marlena, threw a soda in his eyes, he couldn't see very well, that was what caused the accident. And consistently throughout this trial, what we were asserting, we are and continue to assert our errors, went to the heart of that issue. The use of the word corroboration, it was used repeatedly throughout the trial. And what it implied to the jury is that what Mr. Subieski had to do was to corroborate the facts of what he was claiming.
What can a prosecutor say when there is no corroboration?
Well, first, we'd need to be looking at whether someone was available to corroborate that. And I'm not necessarily saying that the use of the term corroboration within a limited capacity is inappropriate. But in this case, the use of corroborate was problematic. But for a witness to be able to make that argument in relation to some witnesses, they would need to be available. And there hasn't been much thought given to how available was this witness, Marlena, who allegedly tossed the soda. We know that there was evidence of a soda within the vehicle. There was a photograph of that, and the jury had that. That was within itself clear corroboration of that somebody must have at some point in time within that vehicle been consuming a soda. But according to Mr. Subieski's...
Well, help me understand your point on this. Let's assume she's seated in the courtroom during the trial. Can the prosecutor say that there was no corroboration of the defendant?
I don't think she was available.
This is a hypothetical. I'm just trying to test the limits of where this rule is that you're looking at.
I would say they would not within that context because she would not have been available. She would not have been available because Mr. Subieski's claim would have put her in jeopardy. She would have been guilty of reckless endangering, assault. So if her version of the testimony would have been consistent with Mr. Subieski's version of the testimony, she would have needed immunity in order to be able to have that. In this case, I wasn't the trial lawyer. It never got down to that road, but I would assert that within that context, there was not an available witness to be able to corroborate the soda in the eyes issue. Furthermore, corroboration was, I would say, a bit not genuine. Law enforcement recovered the vehicle. Law enforcement knew that the lights went out. Law enforcement could have independently have performed some type of an analysis on the vehicle to determine why the lights went out. So to be hammering to the extent that the prosecutor did on corroborate, in fact, inaccurately during the closing arguments, because Mr. Sobieski did, to a certain extent, corroborate through the, at least through the soda can.
Did you argue that to the jury?
I don't believe the trial lawyer did argue that. He may have. I'm sorry, I don't recall. But that would be within the transcript that is the appendix. And then,
well, wasn't corroboration also related to the condition of the car? Some kind of testimony from someone who had examined the car and determined that there was a defect in the dashboard lights?
That never occurred. That never occurred because the state didn't independently perform an analysis, and it never occurred, although the jury wasn't aware of this, it did not occur because the defense did not do that. So within that...
Is that a fair comment, that the defense, who's relying upon an equipment failure, did not produce a mechanic to say the equipment failed?
I think that is a fair comment to one extent, except where it was touching upon the privilege issue of to what extent Mr. Sobieski had the ability to possibly have this independent test performed. I should also note that part of the Hughes/Hunter three-part test is the steps taken to minimize the effects of the errors.
Well, how can you minimize the effects when nobody complained about them?
Well, I do recognize that that would make the ability to minimize difficult. But nevertheless, if there were some steps that were taken to minimize, that would make it more difficult for there to be a finding that the three-part test was violated. The fact that it wasn't raised, I don't think affects the three-part analysis in that there was no ability to cure. There was one objection, the objection to privilege in relation to the questioning about independently having the vehicle examined. So within that context, that was raised. That was overruled.
Could you very quickly give me the gist of what the state's evidence was and what your client's defense was? I mean, I know the defense was that there was a problem with the car and the soda spilling, but what evidence was presented on that point?
Well, the defense's argument was this was an accident. It was a reckless state of mind,
right,
which was also misrepresented by the state.
I'm asking what evidence was presented to support that theory.
The state had independent witnesses who testified about the vehicle speed, which would have been individuals who were working within the zone, the police officer that was pursuing Mr. Sobieski's vehicle. Those individuals all at least gave testimony to the high rate of speed, at least at one point in time. So I would say that was the major component of the case. And then, of course,
the defense, what evidence was presented by the defense?
The evidence that was presented by the defense, well, first off, the turning off the lights, that was consistent with Mr. Sobieski's statement of what happened. The defense was Mr. Sobieski's statement about what occurred as he was driving the vehicle.
That was the sole defense evidence, was his statement?
Correct. And that was the evidence in relation to his absorption of what all was occurring at the moments, right up to the moment of the collision, as within the car, which other individuals would not have been privy to.
Remind us, what was his explanation for the speed? Or did he deny that?
I can't recall if he was admitting to an extent that there was early speeding. I would say that that's still not necessarily controlling to the point of what the speed was at the time just prior to the collision. He did claim he was going slower on the ramp, and that's where what I'll claim some of the prosecutorial misconduct was, of where there was chiding at that moment. And in fact, that's where the comparison to the O.J. Simpson case was raised by trial counsel in order to, I don't understand what the whole theory would be doing that, other than you could say there might have been a factual basis of the O.J. Simpson white Bronco chase down the highway in California was slow in speed, but it also touched upon an area that riles many people's blood. Many people in the United States believe a guilty man got away with murdering viciously two individuals. So
is it your position that that comment was intentionally inflammatory?
Yes. There was no attempt to, I would say, cure it as well, or to put it in any other context. It has no part being raised within any jury trial in the
any
state.
Any reference to Mr. Simpson automatically requires reversal?
No.
How do you draw a line between that which doesn't require reversal and that which does?
Well, first I would say you would need to have repetitive errors. If you're having multiple instances of misconduct or errors, that would be needed. If there was a singular incident of a citation to O.J. Simpson, even with a bad intent, I would say in most instances that would not be enough unless it was some horribly sort of inflammatory comment made.
So what makes the difference here?
It's the combination of everything that occurred, from the touching upon the privilege through the repeated use of the term corroboration, to the demeaning of the defendant, to the inflammatory comment, to the in closing arguments of where there was mischaracterization of the defense theory. This would have been with less than a minute, most likely less than 3 minutes after the defense took the stand. There was a argument by the state as to what the defense's theory was, which was incorrect, as well as the way that the whole corroboration was argued. It was argued that Mr. Sobieski had done absolutely nothing to corroborate when his statements and at least some of the testimony. For example, Mr. Sobieski talked about a cup of soda. The prosecutor at first indicated a can of soda, later corrected himself to indicating, I believe, that it was a soda bottle. So it is those combination of errors, misconduct, repeated use of the word corroborate that implied to this jury that that deliberated up till 7 p.m., all decided to come back the next day, and then it wasn't until the afternoon, probably shortly after 1:30, that they gave the note requiring an Allen charge. All three of the Hughes-Hunter components have been met, and this court has not even required that necessarily all three need to be met in order for the integrity of the judicial process to have been compromised to such an extent that a remand is needed.
For the closeness of the evidence component, an Allen charge was given. It could have been 11 jurors thought the evidence was overwhelming and one juror was having trouble signing on to that. Does that make it close, or is it a matter of counting jurors? Is it a matter of looking at the evidence itself?
I think it would be a combination of those two aspects. I think it does give us a strong indication that a jury deliberating that much is close. Secondarily, the state of mind of Mr. Sobieski was the critical issue. And here's where all the prongs melded together, I think, are what really makes it important. All of the issues of misconduct or error, they all focused on what would be Mr. Sobieski's state of mind at the time that the accident took place. And that's why it is the defense's position that a remand is required. I believe I'm into my...
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the state. This is not a case of a Hughes analysis. This was plain error. In a plain error standard, the court first looks to see if there was misconduct. If there was no objection, you go to Wainwright, to plain error, not to Hughes. There was no objection at any point in time to these alleged multiple repetitive errors at trial, and in fact, there were not multiple repetitive errors at trial.
Well, we're told there was one objection on the issue of attorney-client privilege.
That is correct. And although the court overruled that objection, the prosecutor immediately reframed the question and eliminated the word lawyer and proceeded. There was no need, in fact, for a curative because the prosecutor fixed that himself by removing the word lawyer, even though the objection had been overruled, as he was not particularly looking for what would have been confidential communications. He had originally asked the question, did you get your car checked out? And the defendant had responded that he could not because he was incarcerated. And the prosecutor then asked, well, did you ask your lawyer to do it? And clearly the reason he was asking it that way was because normally if someone's incarcerated, the person they have frequent contact with would be the lawyer, and that would be someone you could ask. Once there was an objection, he moved on and reframed it. Did you ask anyone? So that attorney-client privilege issue is really a non-issue in this case. The OJ remark was very brief. It was related to whether this was a slow-speed chase, as the defendant had testified that he was only going 30 miles an hour, and the police officer had testified that she was speeding to try and catch up with him.
You will agree that that was clearly a sarcastic comment and arguably intended to rouse people up, remind them of OJ and whether they thought that was a horrible verdict or a good one?
I think it was more related to the idea that you could have a slow speed chase. I believe it was sarcastic in the idea and that there would be the idea that you would have a chase that goes at a slow speed, but we know in fact that could happen because it did. In OJ, there was a slow speed chase. The state would not say that it was designed to inflame. It was a sarcastic remark that probably should have been left out. However, it was clearly going to the concept of slow speed chase and nothing more. The state was free to use the word corroboration when talking about evidence presented at trial, whether it be corroboration of the state's witnesses who corroborated each other or the lack of corroboration on any point in the evidence being presented. A witness's credibility is put in front of the jury when they take the stand, and that includes the defendant. And the defendant testified here, and there was no corroborating evidence. That's the way that came in, and corroboration is something, whether a witness's testimony is independently corroborated is a factor the jury is allowed to consider in determining the credibility of a witness. The prosecutor repeatedly, in his rebuttal argument particularly, repeatedly gave the correct standard of the law and pointed out that the defendant had no burden to present evidence in this case. And in light of that, the state would argue that any error was isolated and harmless in the rebuttal. The use of the word corroboration is simply, I believe, not an issue here, and I think it is entirely appropriate. The prosecutor's statement that it was a soda can instead of a soda cup is simply the prosecutor misspeaking, and I don't think it has any relevance whatsoever in this case. Further, if we do go to the Hughes factors in terms, not that the state believes that it's necessary to go to Hughes, but in terms of closeness of case, the state presented clear evidence of reckless behavior on the part of the defendant. It was reckless from the moment he chose to run from the police and speed. And there were multiple witnesses who estimated speed. The defendant himself admitted that it was not a good decision to run from the police. And at that point in time, when he decided to begin what would be a police chase, it was reckless behavior. That reckless behavior became more reckless when he entered in a construction zone. And ultimately, as we know, Mr. Cirillo was seriously injured. So, and there was really no dispute about these facts in general at trial. The whole issue was whether or not, what was mens rea. Well, the state would believe that those actions that were not in dispute, the conduct that was not in dispute, inherently showed reckless behavior. And that was the strength of the state's case. So, although...
Now, the defendant said that his dashboard lights were dark. Is that right?
That is correct. Right.
Was there evidence that his headlights and taillights were illuminated throughout the chase, or was the evidence that he was driving without any lights?
There was evidence that they turned off at a point during the chase. There was also evidence that from the police officer that she could see his brake lights at when he fishtailed, which would indicate that there's some presumption that there was not an electrical malfunction if the taillights showed up.
So he may have accidentally turned off the headlamps? Is that...
Whether he did it on purpose or unintentionally, or whether there was some part that even if they did go out, that doesn't change his conduct, which was fleeing at a high rate of speed after he had been stopped by police and moving on to a highway. And clearly, whether he had his lights on or not, the construction site was illuminated with bright lighting. That's clear. So whether his headlights were on to see the dump truck that was in his path or not, he had still chosen to enter a well-lit, active construction site that had lights on at a high rate of speed being chased by police. In light of that, I think the state had adequately presented a strong case of recklessness. Whether or not the jury deliberated for one day, 2 days, or 3 days does not change the evidence presented and the strength of the state's case. As Your Honor pointed out...
Let me stop you on that point. I thought the whole reason that an Allen charge is given after whatever the trial judge considers to be an appropriate period of time is because the jury is apparently deadlocked, or sometimes even the jury sends out a note and says, we can't reach a decision. Doesn't that pretty much by definition mean that it was a close case, at least in the jury's eyes?
Not necessarily. It could be an 11-1. It could be that there was something they didn't understand about the jury instructions. It doesn't mean that the state's evidence was weak. And in this case particularly, the jury had complex jury instructions to consider with multiple mens rea, recklessness, and criminal negligence. And it was very confusing because they got assault 1, assault 2, vehicular assault 2, and accident instructions. And the interplay of recklessness and cause and the state of mind there in those instructions is pretty complex, and it would not be unreasonable to believe that the jury had some confusion on that. It was certainly different. There were fine lines between some of the levels of intent, and it would take a while to sort those out if a jury was seriously going through what was the mens rea and what was required. So the state would say that that was not certainly not dispositive of that point. The state's position here is that you don't get a perfect trial. There may have been a few glitches in this, but overall the prosecutor presented a clear case, did not cross the line, and correctly challenged the credibility of the witness on the stand. And as such, this was a strong case. There's no need for a reversal of this case. The evidence is clear, and the conduct was reckless, and the verdict was appropriate. Does the court have any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I should first correct my misstatement. The defense contention was criminally negligent action as opposed to recklessness, which was the state's position. But as the state pointed out, the fine lines of the jury instruction, the difficulty of a mens rea type of a position for these jurors to be trying to comprehend and applying it to the facts in this case, I argue that that is further part of the reason why the errors that went to the heart of the issues in this case are such that fundamental fairness, even under the Wainwright standard, requires a remand for a new trial. These jurors, it's difficult to comprehend what is the difference between recklessness, what is the difference between criminally negligent, and the combination of the errors. And I want to highlight I'll call it the overuse of the corroboration, because it was consistently implying that Mr. Sobieski's word on its own isn't enough. He needed something to corroborate it.
Excuse me, are you saying that the defense in closing was arguing that the jury should find him criminally negligent?
Correct. The defense was conceding a conviction of a count, and the jury convicted him of recklessness.
Okay, so if the defendant is conceding that he should be convicted, and the only question is the mens rea, then what does questions about corroboration have anything to do with?
Well, by implying the corroboration, especially the way it was repeatedly done, and then done last, in the rebuttal, in which the defense has no ability to correct the mischaracterizations, corroboration still has importance, and even though we're talking about a defendant whose attorney is admitting that criminally negligent action has taken place.
So a defense verdict would have been guilty of what?
Guilty of, I believe, vehicular assault of second degree. I'm not exactly sure of what the degree was, but the difference would have been he would not have been looking at a mandatory term of life. And so the overall importance of that issue is whether someone could have been incarcerated for 5 years, 10 years, or life without parole.
So if we agree with you that these convictions should be reversed, would it be remanded with instructions to enter a judgment of conviction on the offenses that were conceded?
That would be my hope. That was, I should say, at the least it was conceded by the defense, that certainly would be a just result. I still have additional time, although I have no further presentation. I don't know if there's any other questions from the tribunal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.
Please rise.